Session number 10981, Rule 1.
Sir Ivor Broom, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, about the circumstances of you joining the RAF in 1940, please?
I was living in Ipswich, and 19 years of age, and I used to see the bombers going out low level from Wadisham nearby, and that made me, in April 40, go along to join the Royal Air Force. I was accepted, but extraordinary thing, I was then sent home for 4 months, because of lack of training facilities. I think this is very interesting, because people sometimes don't realize you can't turn a training tap on and off. Training machine had to be built up. So I went home and was recalled on bank holiday Monday, August 1940, to go to the reception training and start training.
What did you think of the quality of the training in the war?
Oh, I thought it was splendid. I suppose the confidence of youth is one of the many factors. I went to the reception centre August 40, and I did my first operational sortie 11 months later in July 1941. I trained basically on tiger moths initially. That may be quite interesting, because it was done 30 miles from London at White Waltham. Whilst the fighting was going on up above, we were flying our little biplane trainers around White Waltham Airfield.
What did you see of the fighting?
Only the contrails, high up in the summertime. One didn't see any actual enemy aircraft. You just saw the contrails.
What was the first squadron, operational squadron, that you went to?
Well, I went on to Blenheim's. My first squadron was at West Raynham, 114 Squadron. At that time, the squadron had two particular roles. It was all daylight operations, I should say. And two types were, first of all, low-level attacks, mast-high attacks on shipping, particularly off the Dutch coast, and then what we called circuses, where we would fly in the squadron formation of 12 aeroplanes. This was now, the Battle of Britain was over. We were now into September, October. Battle of Britain was over. Of course, we were now into 41. And we attacked targets in northern France from heights of about 8,000 feet, I believe, all bombing in formation. When the leader dropped his bombs, you all dropped your bombs. And we were given a very large fighter escort, and really we considered we were very much bait to get the German fighters up in the air for us to attack them, and keep putting for our fighter escort to attack them and put them on the defensive. So we did circus operations and low level shipping, but all daylight. There was, in fact, I think one raid which in my mind sticks out as the one of the most memorable ones for me of World War II. I never forget the date, it's 12th of August 1941, when 54 Blenheims were briefed to carry out the first deep, proper penetration by a major force into Germany proper in daylight. And it was to attack the power stations at Cologne. And we had a fighter escort to the Dutch coast, but then they, of course, couldn't come any further with us. And we then hedge-hopped all the way across Holland. It was the first time lots of people in Holland had obviously seen the RAF, because they waved like mad as we flew over their rooftops in the fields. And, of course, you knew when you'd passed into Germany, because they no longer waved, they dived for cover. We lost 25%. We lost 25% on that raid. It gained a lot of publicity, In fact, on the wall in my study, you will see a print of a painting by Michael Turner, which is of my aeroplane over Cologne, because a photograph of my aeroplane taken by the gunner of another aeroplane appeared in all the press at the time. And that was a 114 Squadron aeroplane, of course.
Can you describe what you did in that raid once you got to Cologne?
Well, the target of the power stations. And so we went in very low level, but in order to get the raid through quickly, you couldn't have people very close at low level behind one another, because they'd be blown up by the bombs in front. Our bombs had 11-second delay fuses. So one wave would go in really low, another zoom up to 1,000 feet, and then... Well, we flew low, very low, over Holland, 50 feet stuff, hedge hopping, until we got within a mile or two of the power stations. We carried bombs with 11 seconds delay, so those who dropped from very low level did not blow themselves up. It gave about 1,000 yards clearance before the bombs exploded. But getting 54 airplanes over the target, you couldn't have them all going quickly at low level, or some might have been blown up by the bombs in front. So one group would go over at 50 feet, the next group at 1,000 feet, and then quickly back down to level again, down to ground level. So you did it in very quick succession, some airplanes at 1,500 feet, some at 1,000 feet. But immediately those at 1,000 feet had bombed, they immediately descended once again down to 50 to 100 feet. And then back all the way across Holland and the North Sea. And as I said earlier, we lost, I think, 12 or 13 aeroplanes out of the 54 that went.
Did you get the impression that they were caught by surprise?
I honestly can't remember. We didn't get much flak opposition, although the photograph I have of my actual aeroplane over the chimneys shows a lot of flak in the sky. But you see, you don't hear it. So you don't really know if people are firing at you unless you see clumps of smoke quite close to you. This is something perhaps people don't quite appreciate. If you were on the ground, it must have sounded terrible, no doubt. Noise of aeroplanes, noise of AK-AK guns. But we'd only hear our own engines. There was some fighter interception, but again, very difficult for them to get their guns on you if you were right down amongst the treetops. So how much opposition there was, I don't know, but we lost, as I say, 25%, so there must have been quite a lot.
What about the target? You had a clear view of the target?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was good weather, very good weather. And in fact, you see, you needed reasonable weather, because your only method of navigation was by visual map reading. And in fact, I, being a very new crew, just stuck on, I was formating on the flight commander, and where he went, I went, and it was just keeping tucked in on him all the way. So I relied, my crew and I relied on his navigation, with my navigator doing his checks, but I am following my leader.
One hears quite a bit of criticism of the Blenheim. Can you tell me what it was like to fly it?
I think you've got to put everything in perspective. The Blenheim is a long story, and I won't go into it, it'll take too long. But in 1939, what did we have in our Air Force? You see? We had ferry battles, we had Blenheims, and we had some Wellingtons, Hamdens, and Whitleys. Not many. There were over 1,000 Blenheims in service throughout the various commands in 1939. And it was a 1935 aeroplane. When it came into service, it was faster than any fighter in the Royal Air Force, because we didn't have the Hurricane and Spitfire. And the Gloucester Gladiator was the sort of one of the main fighters. So it was it was the only aeroplane which was able to carry on daylight bombing in 1939, 40, 41, or after the first few months, the ferry battles were wiped out. the Wellingtons, Whitleys and Hamptons had to concentrate at night because they were so much slower. So I thought the Blenheim was marvellous, but by 41, late 41, it was obsolescent. And any criticisms you might hear of it would be of those who were flying it in 41 or 42, when it was obsolescent. It ceased operating from this country in fairly early on in 1942. Some squadrons started to re-equip with Bostons and Bostons, Mitchells and Venturas in middle-late 1941. But there were still Blenheims around early in 42, and then, of course, the Mosquito started to appear. It remained operating overseas, of course, I believe, down in Burma, Far East, Middle East, into 43.
You were saying how you were trailing a coat in these circuses.
Yes.
Did those tactics succeed?
Oh, yes. And we loved them because we were safe. I mean, I don't remember losing an aircraft on a circus. Though the Ak-Ak came at you, it didn't. We were going to targets in northern France, basically. Shipbuilding yards, coastal ports, those sort of targets. And so we weren't over land for long. And I say we were the bait to get the fighters up so our fighters could attack them.
Presumably, in view of those tactics, you weren't able to penetrate very far into northern France.
No, that's quite right. We didn't go far into northern France with the fighter escorts. They needed all the range they could do for their air fighting over northern France and the Channel area. I don't recall going further than 40 or 50 miles, even that, into northern France.
What targets did you have?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember. I could probably look my logbook up and tell you. But I remember certainly Letray Shipbuilding Yards was one of them. And there was the odd port that we went to. I didn't do many because I was only operating on Blenheims in this country for 2 months, from July to September. And then I went out to the Middle East and Far East. I thought I was going to the Middle East and Far East, but I only got as far as Malta, and then I did a lot of operations from Malta.
Before we go on to Malta, can you tell me a bit more about the attacks on the enemy shipping?
Oh yes, casualties were terrible. I remember one night, the 114 squadron, one evening rather, I'd only been there a week or two, and a new squadron commander just arrived. He went out with two other crews, and all three failed to come back. The method of attack was you would fly very low level, below the height of the ship deck. And your bombs were quite small. Bear in mind, we only carried four 250-pound bombs. Occasionally, people carried two 500. But basically, most of the time, four times 250. And if you dropped those on the top of a ship, they could well bounce off. So, particularly with 11-second delay fuse, they're not going to explode for 11 seconds. So the only way to make sure you actually got your bomb into the ship was to toss it, in effect, into the side of the ship. And then you pulled up over the masts, pushed down the other side to get back as low as you could. And in the Blenheim, whenever you did that manoeuvre, your engine momentarily cut under negative G, and then back down to 50 feet or so. Now, if you were attacking merchant ships which were unescorted, that wasn't too bad. The problem was they had a lot of what were called flak ships, which escorted the merchant shipping along the Dutch coast, all the continental coast. And they were lethal, because they were, as their name implies, flak ships. If they hadn't been successful in getting you before you could bomb, the tendency was to put a curtain of flak just over the ship you were attacking, in the hope that they got you as you went over the ship, having realized they failed to get you on the run in. So the losses were very, very high on shipping. They were not high all on circuses.
So what was morale like in the squadron?
I thought it was tremendous. You see, you think it's never going to happen to you. I mean, I don't remember any chat or discussion or anything about the losses. It's in retrospect, when I look back now, that I realise how heavy they were. But you did your job, you came home, you went out for the evening, you went off to dance or had a do in your mess, whether you were sergeants or NCOs. Our squadron, incidentally, lived off the station at West Raynham in a country house called Weasenham Hall. And there was a marvellous old lady, Mrs. Cook, was the owner of the house, and she still lived there. And the officers were in one part of the house and the sergeants in another part of the house, and that was our squadron mess. We fed there. So you only went to the airfield when you were due to fly, and you went straight to Weasenham Hall when you landed after debriefing.
Did you ever have any cases of what is perhaps rather cruelly known as lack of moral fibre?
Now, how interesting you ask me that. An American major wrote to me a month or two ago saying he was doing a thesis for a master's degree on lack of moral fibre, and could I give him some information about it? And I had to say, I can't. Only once did I know of a man having been taken off a squadron. In fact, it's a squadron when I was commanding a squadron. What was I, a flight commander? I can't remember. On Mosquitoes. And he was a Canadian navigator. And he kept, as he said, feeling ill when he got to altitude and made a lot of early returns. Well, we found out that he wasn't ill at all. And we quietly had him removed. Now, who's going to criticise that guy? A Canadian, volunteered, didn't have to be here. He could have been doing some safe job if he'd sorted out in Canada. I would never criticise that chap. And that's the only... Even in Malta, we had tremendous losses, right, again. And not once did I, do I recall chaps returning early because they didn't have the stomach for what they were going to do.
We get the impression from what we read that in the war, the RAF pilots were part of a glamour service and that they were lionised by the public. Was that true?
I don't know I put it in such graphic terms, but I think it is right to say that you had a very good image with the public. For instance, I remember walking through the underground tube one evening when the platforms were covered with people sleeping there for the night, and I was in uniform, and the number of nice remarks that people made to you as you walked past them. And of course you were very popular at the dances. In Norwich there was a big dance hall called Samson and Hercules, and every night there were air crew at these dances, and you had a marvellous time there. But I wouldn't say lionised. I think you were appreciated and respected. I think those are the words I'd probably use.
What kind of nice remarks would they pass?
Oh, well, I can't remember, but, you know, they were the friendly type of remark, you know. Give it to them sort of thing. And they knew you were a pilot by your wings. And they wanted to show you that they recognised you were a pilot. That's, but the only time I had that was in the underground, where everyone, I say, was sleeping on platforms.
And that year would have been?
1941.
Can we go to Malta now? And can you tell me about going there and the squadron you were with?
Yes, well, to get to Malta, you couldn't fly over France. In fact, I don't think we'd have had the range quite to do it. So we went down to Cornwall, and there was a unit there for dispatching aircraft to the Middle East at Port Reith in Cornwall. And I, believe it or not, was considered to be the most experienced of the group, which I was asked to lead a group of six. And I had about 230 hours, I suppose, total flying at the time. And we flew to Gibraltar. And I know how long that took, because someone asked me only the other day, it took 7 hours to get to Gibraltar from Cornwall. You flew well off the coast of France and Portugal, so you're well out to sea. It took 7 hours. Landed at Gibraltar, where, incidentally, the runway was not the sort of nice long runway you have today. And there was literally a graveyard of wrecked aeroplanes at Malta, where inexperienced crews had not been able to cope with the landing there. Then we took off to go from there to Malta next day. And that took 7 hours 40 minutes. That's a long time. The Mediterranean is a very big sea. It is impossible almost to get a feel for how big it is, because we hardly saw land in that time all the way to Malta. And one amusing but sad incident during that transit flight, we kept radio silence, didn't talk to one another. But one crew, when we'd been going for many, many hours, not seen land at all, because we were well away from the land, decided to go off on its own. Switch it off. This crew, I say, went off on its own. They decided, obviously, they didn't like our navigation. Well, the rest of us got to Malta. He never did. And he either crash-landed or bailed out over Sicily and was a prisoner for the rest of the war while the crew were. Now, when I got to Malta, I thought it was just a refueling stop. And on the next day to Cairo, we had the maps to take us all the way to Singapore, if needs be. But the Air Marshal in charge of Malta was Air Marshal Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd. And he used to replace his losses by a phrase I've used many times, hijacking crews who were in transit. So my refueling stop was not a refueling stop. The next day I found I was with 105 Squadron. And I then operated with 105 Squadron for just a week. At that time, Blenheim squadrons were going out from England for 3 weeks, detachment at Malta, then back. And that'll give you an idea of what the work was like. They changed them every 3 weeks. And 105 came back after his 3 weeks, and I was transferred to 107 Squadron. And 107 Squadron, because the squadrons were re-equipping with airplanes back at home, they had no replacement to send out for us. So 107 Squadron didn't get relieved until January 42. So I did 4.5 months in Malta. And then when we were relieved by, I think, 21 Squadron in January 42, the squadron only lasted a couple of weeks. They were wiped out virtually, and that was the end of Blenheim's at Malta. So I was there with 107 most of my time, and the other squadron was 18, two Blenheim squadrons. And our main role was to attack shipping, taking supplies to Rommel in North Africa, all daylight. And we would go out searching for shipping. And if we couldn't find any ships, and we were down by the North African coast, then we would go inland to find a target of opportunity on the Tripoli-Benghazi road area. And we'd attack a target of opportunity and then back to Malta. So, and again, this was all at low level, 50 feet stuff we're talking about all the time. One interesting fact I think might be worth my telling you. Squadron was asked to attack some very important big ship in a Sicilian harbour. And the harbour was so defended that it was decided it had to be done at night, a moonlight night. And so they picked the two most experienced crews in the squadron to do it, and I was one of them. Now, my total night flying was 7.5 hours. That included my training on airspeed Oxfords, training on the Blenheim. Now, it's 7.5 hours night flying, and I hadn't flown at night since my training conversion 6 months earlier. And we went in low level again in the moonlight, pilot release. All this bombing at low levels done pilot release, not a navigator or bomber, pilot release. And we attacked this big ship in Sicilian harbour at night with 7.5 hours total night flying. I remember the CO of the squadron said to me whilst at the briefing, "Would you like to do a couple of circuits and landings, or circuits and bumps as we called them in those days, before you set course, so you've had a look at what Malta looks like at night with virtually no lighting." Before I could answer, my air gunner said, "Not very likely, let's do the op between the circuit and the bump." And so off we went, and it was a very successful trip.
With these attempts to interdict the shipping for Rommel, was it the same kind of problems that you had attacking the shipping off the Dutch coast?
Almost the same, but the escort vessels were not flagships. They were, because the flagships were little coastal ships which were bristling with guns. They tended more to have naval support for the ships going down to, particularly to Tripoli. So really the opposition was stronger when escorted, but there were times when ships weren't escorted. I'm speaking from memory now, but I believe I am right in saying, and I did a check for this many years ago, and I won't guarantee I'm 100% accurate, but I believe we sunk or damaged 24 ships during my time with 107 Squadron, and we lost 24 crews in that time. And I suppose in war you'd probably say that's not bad arithmetic, but pretty colossal. Now, I was a sergeant pilot when I went to Malta, and we lost virtually all the officers, and we were now left with a squadron leader who was due to go home, his tour expired. He was made acting wing commander till the new one came out. And I was commissioned in Malta, and one night I moved from the sergeant's mess into the officer's mess, and that was my commissioning. I went down to Malta and bought myself a forage cap from Gives in Lucca in Malta, and a few inches of powered officer braid, and took the sergeant's stripes off my uniform, stowed on the powered officer braid, and that was my commissioning and moving into the officer's mess.
Did it make a great deal of difference to you becoming an officer?
No. Not at all. The only difference was that I was no longer living with the squadron. You see, the squadron, again, didn't live on the airfield at Lucca, which is now Malta Airport. We lived off the airport on a little coastal place where there were some coastal old barracks of type of buildings. Marsha Sherlock, I think it was called, or some such name. And again, like at West Raynham, you came to the airfield for you to fly, and when you finished flying you went back to Master Sherlock. Now the only difference with an officer was you lived on the airfield at Lucca. From the personal point of view it made very little difference, except I didn't see so much of my friends because we were living in separate places. In fact, I remember I shared a room with a Canadian, and when I moved in his remarks to me, in great jest, but jokingly in fun, said, "Well, you're my third roommate this week. I hope you're going to stay a bit longer than the others."
Did the Germans adopt intruder tactics in Malta, waiting for you to come back?
No. Their attacks were all attacks on Malta itself, whether it was the harbour or whether it was the airfields. Didn't bother about us flying to and from our areas where we were searching for shipping. It's It's very interesting because radar is very primitive in those days. And just off the south coast of Malta, there's a rock called Filfla Rock. It must be about a mile or so off coast shore. And when we came back, we always had to come to Filfla Rock to help in identification, because we'd be coming back low level. And we had to go to Filfla Rock, where the gunners could see we were coming in from that one area. And so they helped in identification.
We hear all about the siege of Malta and Fortress Malta and so on. How grim was the atmosphere during that period?
Well, again, you see, I didn't really notice it. I'm awfully sorry. Some people might have done. The big thing we noticed, and I've said this before, we didn't get one ship come into Malta with supplies in the 4.5 months I was there. And as I've said elsewhere, we lived on McConaughey's, which was meat and vegetable tinned. And we had it in every guise and form you can have it. So the food was dull and repetitive. We had this M&V fried, stewed in pies. We had it curried. All sorts of ways it was done.